From the silver screen to the printed page to the woods behind your house, incredible creatures are everywhere. For as long as I can remember, monsters have populated the landscape of my imagination. As a kid, I wanted to learn as much as I could about these legendary figures, and it turns out, I still do. I'm Mark Matzke, and this is Monster Study Group. If you're using the Dewey Decimal System, go directly to the shelves at 1.9 and pull all the Bigfoot books you can find, because it's going to be that kind of session today, a Sasquatch-centric explosion of information and opinion. If you're new to Monster Study Group, thanks for joining the fun, and I invite you to check out our Instagram account, which is simply Monster Study Group, where I post about this show as well as our alliance with the Rondo-nominated podcast Monster Kid Radio. We're going to jump right into the research today with a retrospective look at one of my favorite films of all time, The Legend of Boggy Creek. A couple of things warrant mention, the first being this article was written before Pamela Pierce Barcelew, daughter of director Charles B. Pierce, released the restored Blu-ray for Boggy Creek, which in a strange and roundabout way my son helped inspire. Here's what I mean. In 2019, Pam and her husband Dave heard Andy speak at the International Cryptozoology Conference in Portland, Maine. And in his talk, he referenced the impact The Legend of Boggy Creek had on him. And bear in mind, he was 16 years old when he gave this speech. His comments became a kind of proof of concept for Dave and Pam, convincing them an audience, a younger audience, was there for the restored release, which I know because they told us as much when we met up at Monster Bash in October 2021. As improbable as that sounds, it is 100% true, and it just makes me smile knowing Andy influenced a portion of Boggy Creek history. The article you're about to hear is something that I wrote for Mad Scientist Magazine, issue 22, which has long been out of print. It captures my thoughts about the legend of Boggy Creek as they stood in 2010, 6 years before we set foot in Fauk, Arkansas. Come with me down to the banks of the Sulphur River. The flies are buzzing, the bullfrogs are croaking, and let me tell you a story about a creature who always travels the creeks. On the track of the ultimate Bigfoot movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek. Bigfoot and I go way back. I owe my introduction to the hairy hominid to Sid and Marty Croft, whose Croft Super Show of 1976 featured 15-minute episodes of Bigfoot and Wild Boy. Needless to say, my 4-year-old self envied Wild Boy's friendship with the big biped, and the show inspired many imaginary adventures played out in the wilderness of my basement. The same year saw Steve Austin tangling with Bigfoot, as played by both wrestler Andre the Giant and actor Ted Cassidy on The $6 Million Man. Sasquatch ruled the small screen in 1976, much to my delight. Over the next couple of years, I could not help but dig deeper into Bigfoot lore, and since my research took place during the Bigfoot boom of the 1970s, my local library yielded no shortage of Sasquatchiana. Marion T. Place's On the Track of Bigfoot became my primary text. While comprehensive and readable, it gave the distinct impression that Bigfoot was exclusively ensconced in the Pacific Northwest, It wasn't until I got my hands on works such as Elwood Bauman's Monsters of North America and Place's subsequent Bigfoot All Over the Country that I learned that reports of giant man-apes were far more widespread than I had been led to believe. What's more, Bauman's book devoted three whole chapters to a series of sightings in Fauk, Arkansas, sightings that had evidently inspired an honest-to-goodness Bigfoot docudrama called The Legend of Boggy Creek, made in 1972. It became a fervent hope of mine to see this movie, although the chances of catching it on television seemed about as good as seeing a 7-foot-tall hairy primate in my own backyard. For years, Bauman's description of the legend of Boggy Creek fired my imagination, and I had come to accept that the images it produced in the theater of my mind would probably have to suffice. My hopes for seeing the film would rise, however, whenever it was mentioned in books such as Janet and Colin Board's The Bigfoot Casebook. At the very least, I could take comfort in knowing the movie really existed and that someone, somewhere, had seen it. And then, one day, in my early teens, it appeared. There, in the television listings, which I habitually scoured for monsters of all persuasions, was the title, The Legend of Boggy Creek. It was scheduled to run far too late for me to stay up and watch, but fortunately my family had purchased our first video cassette recorder. With the precision of a surgeon, I set the timer, double-checking my work, and then it was done. All I could do was wait and hope. The next morning, I rewound the tape, took a deep breath, and pushed play. These orange words appeared against a plain black background. "This is a true story." Some of the people in this motion picture portray themselves, in many cases on actual locations, after years of waiting. The legendary Bigfoot was in my possession. When I finally had the long-awaited pleasure of watching The Legend of Boggy Creek, I was not disappointed. If anything, it was more absorbing than I had hoped. Moreover, it felt plausible, and some of the vignettes were genuinely unnerving, beginning with a sequence in which a young boy runs from the sound of a howling Bigfoot, admitting in voiceover that, "I was 7 years old when I first heard him scream. It scared me then, and it scares me now." After quickly establishing the geography and general culture of Fauk, which is to say the deep south of the early 70s, two eyewitnesses report their experiences on location in a matter-of-fact tone that roots the proceedings in reality. One of the men eerily relates the tale of his 200-pound show hogs being carried away by something over a barbed wire fence. Two reenactments follow in which hunters run across the creature ambling through the woods. These scenes avoid sensationalism and give the viewer a sense of what seeing an unknown creature must be like. The costume used for these scenes is effective in that it's never glimpsed in much detail, and the suit actor moves about naturally, giving the impression of something large and hairy, yet not abnormal. Next, three women and a baby living in a backcountry shack are terrorized by a nighttime visit from the creature. The monster's appearance is only hinted at, yet the sequence is gripping. It also concludes with a mildly disturbing image of a cat that had been scared to death by its close encounter with the cryptid. That is followed by an intense segment in which an adolescent hunter brings the hominid to its knees with a couple of rifle shots. The young actor in this segment is convincingly spooked, and the viewer is too. film offers a slight breather at this point, showing hunting parties and tracking dogs searching in vain for Bigfoot. More unpredictably, a musical montage begins. The plaintive Ballad of Boggy Creek, written by Earl E. Smith and sung by Charles B. Pierce, is set to shots of both the natural beauty of the Sulphur River bottoms and the lonely Fowk monster trudging along the creek bed. The lyrics ask, "Here the Sulphur River flows, rising when the storm cloud blows. This is where the creature goes, lurking in the land he knows. Perhaps he dimly wonders why is there no other such as I? To love, to touch before I die, to listen to my lonely cry." As one musical interlude ends, another takes its place. This one is dedicated to Travis Crabtree, a teenage trapper and outdoorsman. We learn that Travis, in his forays up and down the river, occasionally visits Herb Jones, a man who lives in seclusion deep in the swamps. Jones, who seems like someone who should know, steadfastly declares that there ain't no such thing as the Fowk monster. Jones's denial notwithstanding, evidence is presented in the form of large, three-toed footprints discovered in a bean field. This serves as a transition to another recreated sighting. Three young children lead their aunt to the place where they claim they saw a wild man, and right on cue, he appears upon their return. It's a simple setup made effective by the panic reaction of the woman who paradoxically screams, "Don't run!" as the group flees in horror. The scene that follows is one of my favorites because it depicts a staple of Bigfoot sighting lore, the old road crossing scenario. It happens quickly. In less than 5 seconds, the thing has crossed the road and hidden in the woods. This is a situation I had read about and visualized for years, and to see it captured on film was oddly thrilling. Another creepy vignette portrays the monster stalking a trailer full of teenage girls. Their fear is palpable as they pull out Daddy's gun and fumble for bullets on the kitchen floor. When one of the girls musters up the courage to peek out the window, the viewer knows what is coming, yet it's hair-raising all the same. The final portion of the movie is its longest set piece, an account of the events experienced by the Ford family as something big tries to enter their homestead. The most dramatic elements of the real-life Ford encounter, as documented in Bauman's book, are brought to life, such as a hairy hand reaching in through an open window and Bobby Ford crashing in through the screen door in an effort to escape the creature's clutches. Unfortunately, this sequence features both the most and least convincing monster appearances in the film. When the shadow of the creature slinks across the porch and the boards creak under its weight, the effect is chilling. However, when Bobby Ford finally collides with the creature in the front yard, an ill-fitting gorilla mask complete with loose eye holes is easily glimpsed by the viewer, and the spell of suspense is broken. That's the only misstep that the movie makes in portraying the monster, and it's a shame that it takes place during what is effectively the climax of the film. Boggy Creek's denouement is a moody shot of a man, the narrator and grown-up version of the boy in the prologue, inspecting an old cabin while reflecting in voiceover on the mystery of the Fowk sightings. The viewer almost expects one last shock to occur, but it never does, and the movie seems to coast to a stop, like the funhouse ride it is. Charles B. Pierce caught lightning in a bottle with The Legend of Boggy Creek, managing not only to bring the Fauk phenomenon to light, but also to preserve a snapshot of Southern culture in a way that does not feel exploitative. Whether by design or budgetary necessity, Boggy Creek is a study in understatement, which is perhaps a strange thing to say about a Bigfoot movie. What is far stranger is that Pierce would take precisely the opposite approach in filming Boggy Creek 2 and The Legend Continues in 1985, employing crude Southern caricature, mild lasciviousness, and much monstrous melodrama. It's a film custom made for the Mystery Science Theater 3000 treatment, which it received in 2004. At one point, host Mike Nelson quips, "With the degree in Boggy Creek Studies, you can pretty much write your own ticket." While it makes for a fantastic MST3K episode, Boggy Creek 2 raises questions about Pierce's true feelings for the subject matter, illustrating that there's a fine line between cult classic and B-movie embarrassment. In addition to Pierce's own ill-conceived sequel, The Legend of Boggy Creek inspired a wave of Sasquatch cinema, such as 1975's The Mysterious Monsters, a straightforward documentary narrated by Peter Graves, 1976's The Creature from Black Lake, an affable tale featuring the menacing talent of Jack Elam, and 1978's Sasquatch, The Legend of Bigfoot, which seems consciously patterned after Boggy Creek's docudrama structure. Bigfoot stomped his way onto the small screen as well in the aforementioned Bigfoot and Wild Boy and $6 Million Man series, as well as more sober fare such as the Leonard Nimoy narrated In Search Of. Pierce, who died on March 5, 2010, helped make Bigfoot a household name in the 1970s, and in the process, enjoyed modest financial success. The peculiar, haunting quality of The Legend of Boggy Creek gave some viewers not just a few moments of escapist entertainment, but a calling to pursue. In his book, Bigfoot, The True Story of Apes in America, renowned cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman names no less than 10 prominent individuals whose participation in current Bigfoot research is a direct result of seeing the Boggy Creek movie. One of those named by Coleman is Chester Moore Jr., the author of Bigfoot South. His comments are fairly typical of those whom Coleman profiles. "Seeing The Legend of Boggy Creek lit my interest in the Bigfoot phenomenon into a full-blown passion. While the Pacific Northwest seemed a world away to me, Arkansas did not. The impact it had on me as a youngster was immense." Moore's statement helps explain Boggy Creek's enduring appeal. The picture suggests, especially to younger viewers, that deep mystery might lurk closer to home than anyone expects. While hardly told from a skeptical viewpoint, the film is earnest in its presentation of regular people grappling with inexplicable events, with the documentary style highlighting the sense of extreme possibility. Pierce's film is nothing less than a great American campfire story. Scary, fun, and just believable enough to make you reconsider your next woodland hike. My hunt for this elusive quarry was well worth it. The books mentioned in this article include Elwood Bauman's Monsters of North America, published in 1978 by Xerox Education Publications, Janet and Colin Board's The Bigfoot Casebook, from 1982, published by Stackpole Books, Lauren Coleman's Bigfoot, The True Stories of Apes in America, 2003, Paraview Pocket Books, and Marion T. Place, On the Track of Bigfoot, Dodd, Mead and Company, 1974. In 2011, a TV show called Finding Bigfoot made its debut on the cable station Animal Planet. Running for 7 years, this often debated reality program was a pop culture phenomenon, raising awareness about the subject of Bigfoot and making new media celebrities of its four main personalities. My son and I paid close attention to each episode. And at the time the show was making its initial impression, we were living in Southeast Ohio, a region of the state renowned for alleged Bigfoot activity. So it happened that the production team of Finding Bigfoot arranged a recording session in our neck of the woods in early 2012. And, well, keep listening to this article dated March 2nd of that year, entitled Monsterland, Ohio, Finds Bigfoot. In mid-January, Andy and I had an unusually unique experience. We participated in the filming of an episode of Animal Planet's Finding Bigfoot that took place less than an hour from our home. It was a remarkable day, one that we will not soon forget. I found out about the filming session through a notice in our local newspaper that I happened to see about 2 weeks in advance. I kept it quiet until the day before it happened so that Andy wouldn't get overexcited or let his hopes get too high, lest fate intervened and we could not go, and that is almost what happened. The night before the taping, we got one of the worst ice storms of the year. Not much, but enough for the local sheriff's office to issue a level 1 snow emergency that morning. We seriously contemplated not making the 45-minute drive, but then decided to give it a try rather than not. It was a great decision. Once we got to the expressway, it was relatively smooth sailing, and we soon found ourselves pulling into the parking lot of Deerassic Park, a nature preserve, near the entrance to Salt Fork State Park. We'd given ourselves plenty of extra time to get there, so much so that we were probably the first audience members to arrive. What this meant for us soon became clear when Renee Holland approached us, noticed Andy's I Believe Salt Fork t-shirt, and generally made us feel very welcome. It was a cool precursor to the day's activities. Within minutes, the other members of the cast trickled in, and we were able to meet and speak with Cliff Berrickman and Bobo. Andy, in particular, got to spend some quality time with Cliff as they talked about what makes for good Sasquatch habitat and places in our region where they have been sighted. Bobo was just as approachable and laid back as he appears on camera. In fact, one thing that stood out is that the stars of Finding Bigfoot aren't acting. They truly seem to just be themselves, whether the cameras are rolling or not. As the crowd began to swell, we found good seats near the front and got to know some of the folks around us. I was surprised to see a couple who had appeared in the Ohio Grassman episode of Monster Quest and got to talk with them at length about their experiences. Folks brought in artwork, alleged Bigfoot casts, and photos. It was a festive atmosphere. Then we started to learn some of the trade secrets of quote-unquote reality television. Thank you. This episode of Finding Bigfoot was to be a clip show, or a best of, so the cast would be introducing and commenting on footage from season 2 episodes, some of which had not yet aired. If you've seen the show, then you know that one element of Finding Bigfoot's formula is the town hall meeting, during which people share their opinions and encounters. However, to prompt the best responses from the cast, the production crew handed out index cards with questions already printed out, and asked members of the audience to ask them as if they were their own. Our excitement reached a new level when both Andy and I were invited to participate. My question was in reference to the Baby Bigfoot episode, and Andy's was about the Canadian Rockies expedition. We did our best, and could only wonder if we would make it into the final cut. All told, the recording took about 5 hours, which was whittled down to about 20 minutes of footage once the episode summaries and previews were added. So much interesting stuff was left on the cutting room floor, including Bobo's in-depth description of a controversial Bigfoot kill, and the cast's candid opinions of Todd Standing, whose Sylvanic project purports to have clear footage of Bigfoot. Matt made it pretty clear that he thinks Standing is a charlatan. As someone who's a public speaker by vocation, I must say that I came away from this experience very impressed by the entire cast's ability to speak extemporaneously. Even Bobo, who some might consider the least polished of the foursome, is in his own way a master storyteller, someone to whom you can't help but listen, and his natural humor endears him to his fans. This series benefits tremendously from the cast's success at articulating their viewpoints, whether you agree with them or not. Once the filming was done, the cast members stayed until every last hand had been shaken. Renee Holland had special promo cards made up especially for young fans, and Andy got the signatures of the Big Four. We shared a really nice moment with her as our father and son connection brought to mind memories of her father, who is responsible for her interest in the Bigfoot phenomenon. More than anyone, I think she understood what we were doing there. Did I mention the catered meal? We were served pizza, hot Italian subs, and salad just for showing up. And in case you were wondering, Finding Bigfoot: Secrets of the Search aired February 26th, and Andy and I both appeared on screen asking our respective questions. Thank you, Finding Bigfoot, for the legendary memory. Well, that'll do it for today's studies. It's really fun for me to reminisce, and I hope you find it enjoyable as well. As it turns out, this would not be the only recording of Finding Bigfoot we would attend, but that's another story for another time. And you may wonder, how can I watch this episode of Finding Bigfoot? And I wish I could tell you. Like the namesake of the show, this episode has vanished. After being shown repeatedly by the network, it doesn't show up anywhere I can find. Strangely appropriate. If you, as my study partner, would ever like to write in and have your research included in the show, drop me a line at mark_Matzke, M-A-T-Z-K-E, at yahoo.com, or send a DM on Instagram. It would be interesting to have a write-in study session, but that's completely up to you. Once again, thanks for listening, and remember to put a blanket on the baby and stay out of the bayous at night.